Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Brody. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Governor Deval Patrick.
As you know, hello.
He joins us. Hello there, Governor. He joins us every month for Ask the Governor, and he will take your calls at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Good to see you, Governor Patrick.
Nice to see you.
Hello, Governor Patrick. So Jim Brody has been kind of ranting and raving all morning about the mayor's election.
Not,
he has.
Not Jim Brody. Ranting and raving.
Ranting and raving about the mayoral election in Boston. He's upset about a low turnout. He's upset about what's the term of the day, the Irish chest thumping, because we have another Irish guy.
I didn't put it that way, but go ahead.
Running the town, that we didn't have in a minority, majority city and all that kind of stuff. What is your take on the mayor's race, Governor Patrick? I'm sure you know Representative Walsh and City Councilor John Conley.
I do. I know them both and a number of the other candidates. You know, Charlotte is a friend and a colleague, Charlotte Golar-Ritchie and Felix Arroyo was helpful in my first campaign, very active in it. John Barros is someone we've worked with through the Neighborhood Coalition, and is just an incredible person. It was fun that it was such a rich and deep field, and I think if you noticed, both of the prevailing candidates in the preliminary, among the first things they said was how important it was to reach out to all communities in the Commonwealth in the city, and I think that's very important. I think the presence of residents and voters who are of the wide variety of backgrounds we have in the city and indeed in the Commonwealth is something that wise political figures and would-be leaders are taking account of and having to deal with, and that's good.
By the way, Marjorie misstated my position a little, so if I may recharacterize.
Okay, dig out of the hole, Jim.
You know, we talked before, I think it was with Brian McGrory a couple of minutes ago. 30 years ago, Mel King got 48,000 votes when he gets in the runoff with Ray Flynn, obviously the first African-American to be in a final. We were two-thirds white then. We're now a majority-minority city. And this is not negative at all about the two men who did well enough to be in the final. But the fact that no person of color made it into the final, what does that say to you about the city in 2013?
Well, first of all, when Mel King ran, how many candidates were in the field?
Nine.
So this is a bigger field.
It's a bigger field.
That's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing I'd say is that you know, the population of color is not monolithic, and they're not focused on color alone. They're focused on crime and education and job opportunities and affordable housing and so on. And I think that has to be acknowledged and credited. And I think the successful candidates are the ones, number one, who were, and I would say many of the candidates were successful. I'm not talking about success just in the sense of the two who emerged from the preliminary, but that the successful candidates were the ones, number one, who spoke to those aspirations and those concerns of all of the citizens, and number two, who built at the grassroots, which is, you know, just you've heard me say it before. Never, ever underestimate the power of the grassroots.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to speak directly to the governor. If you want to email a question in, you can do that at wgbhnews.org. And we have a ton of tweeted questions. They go to @BOS Public Radio.
We're moving on from the mayor's race.
Yes, we are.
Okay. They're up on Beacon Hill today debating this technology tax. And this has been kind of confusing for people because at the beginning, you and many other people were all in favor of this tech tax. Now you're not in favor of this tech tax, and other people aren't either. So what happened?
I think we listened and learned. It was among a host of things in my original budget. You remember that I proposed. The legislature went in a very different direction, as you recall, with the support of the business community, indeed with the support of the Mass High Tech Council. And when they put out the bill that they ultimately announced, Mike Widmer from Mass Taxpayers Foundation, the Mass High Tech Council, the Chamber, the AIM, all the business leaders put out very supportive statements. And some of those same business leaders were the ones leading the charge ultimately to repeal it, which I think, by the way, is part of the reason why it's confusing to people and part of why the politics of this is complicated on Beacon Hill.
Right.
But I remember we had a conversation in the summertime, I called the speaker. This is after session. I had calls individually with the speaker and the Senate president, and then together with them just to get a sense about what they wanted to do and how they were thinking about it. And then we convened leaders from the tech industry. Because remember, DOR, which is the agency that's responsible for enforcing this and writing the rules, Department of Revenue, had been very involved with the industry leadership about how to write the rules so that they were plain and simple, understandable, and limited. And the more they worked with the industry and the more the industry got involved with DOR, the clearer it was that it was hard to write clear rules. And so when we got everybody together, not everybody, but a representative group of industry leaders with the speaker and the Senate president and the governor's office, and we were talking about what the right solution is, I think some came into that meeting thinking, let's figure out a way to interpret this so everybody is comfortable and it's workable, and then came out of the meeting thinking, you know what, it may be that the better solution is just to make it go away. And I'm, you know, leaving aside whether it could have been, you know, whether it actually is so complicated as to be harmful to the industry, and I think that's a debatable question. But the impact on our reputation as a tech hub was, to me, very worrisome, and that's one of the reasons why I came around.
Can we spend a minute before we get to the calls on what the money was going to go for? You originally wanted roughly $1 billion for transportation infrastructure and a variety of transportation things. You got $500 million, give or take a few, in new taxes, including the $161 million for the tech tax. The legislature argues a few hundred million more, at least until those tolls come down. Forgetting that for a second, they seem to show no interest in replacing the $161 million, except maybe on a one-time basis out of the rainy day fund, which I know you're not crazy about because it's supposed to be for emergencies. So you got maybe two-thirds of what you wanted with money for a really important priority. You're now about to lose another $161 million. What do you do?
Well, it's very concerning. I mean, I've been clear both publicly and privately that the transportation financing that the legislature ultimately enacted over my veto is not adequate for our needs. And I would just offer a friendly correction. I didn't want $1 billion. We need $1 billion to deliver a modern transportation system. And I did a lot of work with a lot of people inside the legislature and in the business community to create an environment where they could do that. Not necessarily in the way that I had originally proposed, but I put a lot of things on the table so they could take things off the table and be the ones whittling it down. But I think that the appetite in the legislature for dealing with this right now is just not very great. And that's too bad, but it's not something I can control.
So would you buy a solution?
The public needs to understand we're going to need to come back to this, probably after I have left. Meaning after my term is over, we are going to have to come back to it. But in the meantime, we're going to make the investments we can and get as far along as we can before I leave.
Well, I want to ask you about one of those investments, and then finally we'll get to the calls. You were trumpeting the other day that a major environmental hurdle, if that's a proper use of the term, had been overcome, and to the joy of people in the South Coast, that the South Coast Rail was proceeding apace. You get roughly two-thirds of the money you want. Then you lose another $161 million, theoretically, maybe replaced for 1 year, maybe not. How do you lose that much money and then go ahead with a proposition that could cost a couple of $1 billion?
Well, it's going to cost about $1.8 billion, and we'd be crazy not to do it, frankly, because there is a workforce and a stock of affordable housing and job opportunities there and all along the corridor, which cannot be unlocked without transportation infrastructure, and particularly this train, which was wonderful when we were down there to announce what you referred to as a what'd you call it?
A hurdle, whatever, yeah.
Was the approval process from the Army Corps of Engineers for the preferred route, which is the fastest and most economic route. And we applied for this 5 years ago, I think it was. and it was just approved on Monday. So a huge element of this project has been achieved, and really we're now ready to get into design and construction, final design and construction. And when we were down there to announce this in New Bedford, I called attention to the fact that the train stopped running, by the way, on this same right-of-way 55 years ago. And a gentleman came up to me and said, I was the ticket taker on that last train 55 years ago. He's in the early 90s. He had on his tea cap. It was so much fun. And he said, I said I was going to be here when that train started again, which made me think we better get on with the construction.
But how can you afford? I guess what my question was, quickly, if I can.
It's going to have to
come. Where's the money come from when you're losing them?
It's going to have to come from other things. I mean, this is, right before we went right before we went on the air, Jim,
yeah.
And you were asking, I was telling you that I was out in Malden today having a walk around Malden, the downtown area near the T-stop. And because of the Orange Line and a little bit of public infrastructure investment, private investors are coming in and building a half a dozen different housing initiatives, some market rate, some affordable, and also mixed-use development going on in the area close to the T-stop. And that's what has to happen. We have to start connecting these dots and stop talking about transportation as if it's some abstract thing out there that isn't related to meeting our housing needs, our job creation needs, and the rest.
Okay, we're talking with Governor Deval Patrick, and let us take some calls. Go ahead, Governor. There's your calls.
Let's see. Brian is calling from Arlington. Brian?
Yes, Mr. Governor. I have sort of a big picture question that I've never really understood about Massachusetts politics and taxation, and that is, why do we have basically a flat tax rather than progressive taxation?
You're talking about income tax, Brian?
Yeah. Why haven't you tried to change that as governor since we've actually made it more regressive with a higher sales tax, too, now? So if we're supposedly more progressive than the rest of the nation, why do we have a federal progressive income tax, but it's basically flat on the state level, and what can we do about that?
Great question. So first of all, leaving aside the qualification there about our being a progressive state. We have a flat tax because the Constitution requires a flat tax, and making it progressive in the sense that I think you mean requires a constitutional change, which is not easy to do and shouldn't be easy to do. What I did propose this last year was a way to, through exemptions, have it effectively more progressive, which means to say that if we'd raised the income tax and lowered the sales tax and raised the exemptions as I proposed, then for half the people in the Commonwealth who are in the middle or working poor, their total taxes would either stay the same or go down. And for the people who are making a little bit more, in many cases a lot more, they'd pay a little bit more. But that's the kind of tax – that's the kind of thing we can do. And I'm sorry if this sounds a little too wonkish, but that's the kind of thing we can do in the absence of a constitutional change. Although, Jim, didn't you work on this?
Yes.
I may have done it.
It was in his Robin Hood days. I didn't know if the governor was aware of
Robin
that.
Robin Hoodian is the appropriate
– Yes.
By the way, the answer is –
You want to speak to Brian then?
There have been five attempts to amend the Constitution. I led the effort in the 90s, the fifth unsuccessful time. And, Brian, the good news is we lost by a narrow 71-29% margin. So the appetite for it apparently is not there yet, but the governor's right. You have to amend the Constitution.
Well,
it's a real tedious process.
The appetite for amending the Constitution, I cannot speak to, but all the polling, including in your paper, Marjorie,
you're correct.
Was in favor of the design of what we had proposed. I mean, all of it. I don't think there was one poll against it.
Well, there was a lot of fear on the other side. We can talk about that another day. But Brian, thank you so much for the call, Governor.
Ned is calling from Newton. Ned.
Jim and Marjorie, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great. And it's a wonderful opportunity to talk to you, Governor. And I just wanted to say that I was at the public hearing with the Public Safety Committee of the legislature last week on the gun reform legislation that's been proposed.
Yes.
And you were wonderful. And
thank you.
Very great to know that somebody in your position of power is speaking aggressively about this issue. It seems like a real opportunity for us, yet I sense the possibility that this may slip away. I know Speaker DeLeo set up a task force, but really haven't gone anywhere with it. Hoping that Representative Naughton, who's the chair of the Public Safety Committee, is going to move this along and we'll get something constructive. But
did you stay for the whole hearing, Ned?
I think it was, 10, 12 hours long?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I was there for about 4 or 5 hours,
mm-hmm.
So not the whole a lot of emotion, as you can imagine.
Right.
Hearings from,
on both sides.
Gun owners, a lot of it. But we need some specific steps to be taken. I'm concerned the opportunity may slip away as it did, nationally.
Mm.
And I'm wondering what your feeling is as to whether or not we're going to have some real change.
I don't know. And that's an honest answer. I mean, we have, and many people point to it with pride, and I do too. We have the most restrictive gun laws in the country, or among the most restrictive gun laws in the country, right now in Massachusetts. At the same time, you can buy guns in bulk, and it's hard for me to understand why, when we have the problem of so-called straw purchases, where people buy lawfully in bulk and then sell them on, in some cases, unlawfully, or to people who are not lawfully authorized to own guns, why we can't slow that process or in some way intervene in that problem. The assault weapons and are banned in Massachusetts. There is at least some ambiguity about high capacity magazines. I think I'm using the right term, but the.
You put a lot of bullets in and shoot a lot
exactly.
at one time.
I think there's at least some ambiguity around that. And by the way, I think there's some consensus, Ned, about expanding the background checks to include accessible information around mental health without compromising the privacy interests of patients. Hank Naughton, whom you mentioned, Chairman Naughton on the House side, has done a tremendous amount of work moving the committee hearings around the state and really listening hard to everybody. And there are a number of different proposals out there, and I think he wants to come up with an omnibus bill, not to say that it has every proposal that has been made, but those around which there is most consensus. And I would love to see that enacted or acted on by the legislature soon.
Governor, a couple of questions. Ned, thank you very much for the call. Just if people don't know, you proposed getting rid of not allowing this straw purchase thing where
right.
somebody does. And you've proposed repeatedly, and I have no idea what the argument against this is, limiting purchases to one gun a month. But I have two questions for you. One, why waste any time strengthening gun laws on a state level when, no matter how strong they are, you can drive up to New Hampshire
yeah.
or to another state and do
yeah.
it. Isn't it it's all feds? And
yeah.
number two, would any mental health change that you proposed or supported have caused an Aaron Alexis, for example, who was never committed to anything? All he had done, he had seen a
You're
shrink.
You're talking about the fellow from the Naval Yard?
The shooter at the Navy Yard.
Yeah.
Is there anything that would have been – that you proposed or supported that would have – captured, I don't mean that literally, but it would have
I don't I know where you're going.
Yeah.
I don't know the I don't know the answer to that. It's very interesting. I visited with two of the parents of two of the children who were killed at Sandy Hook
mm-hmm.
right before my testimony, and they come up and I believe they testified that day as well.
Yeah, they did.
At the hearing. Amazing people, amazing strength, and really quite moving how they have taken their grief and turned it into a very respectful advocacy. And when I say respectful, I mean of the arguments on the other side as well. And one of the parents said to me that she wasn't confident that the elements around, of the proposal she was going to testify about necessarily would have prevented what happened. She said, but it was important to act where we could to limit the unlawful access of highly dangerous guns. And if she had some – and she felt, and I think – the rest of us did. She has some pretty strong credibility on that subject.
We're talking to Governor Deval Patrick. You can speak to him directly at 877-301-8970.
Now, I want to ask you one quick thing before we get back to the calls about you've been down stumping for Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, who's running for the United States Senate down in New Jersey.
I have to tell you a funny story.
Oh, tell us.
I'm sorry.
Tell your story.
Question. So I went down to there were two celebrations of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
Uh-huh.
And there was one on a Saturday and then one on the actual
okay.
day in August.
Okay.
And I went down to the one on a Saturday and Mayor Booker spoke, as did others. It was a wonderful speech. It was a very moving time. And after the program, there was to be a march. And I couldn't stay for the march. So the speaking finished and I started to leave. And I'm heading back to catch my ride to get to the airport, and this guy comes running up. Huge crowd there. This guy comes running up. Mr. Booker. and I didn't, you know. I
hope you didn't disabuse him.
First of all, I didn't turn because it wasn't me. And he comes up and he said, and then he, you know, he grabbed me on the shoulder and he said, you're Cory Booker. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, come on. He said, I'm Cory Booker. You're Cory Booker. Let me take a picture with you. And I said, you see how tall I am or am not? I said, I am not Cory Booker.
Did you take the picture?
I took the picture.
Did you tell him who you were?
No, I think he sorted it out.
You should be flattered.
Cory Booker's a handsome
guy. He's a handsome guy. Not that you aren't, of course, Governor Patrick.
Thank you for cleaning that up.
What I wanted to ask you about is you were pretty tough when you were talking. Here's the quote from what you had to say when you were down there. You were talking about the Booker's opponent and other Tea Party conservatives that are trying to defund Obamacare as, quote, a band of radicals who want to drag the country and its economy over a cliff. It's amazing that people would publicly advocate to harm American citizens as a policy position. That's a tough quote. On the other side, there are people who like Obamacare and are very happy that we're going to have some health insurance, who still don't understand, you know, what we're going to get, what we're not going to get.
Yeah.
Is it going to cost us money? Is it going to
The first thing – I'm sorry. You say
– No, I'm just wondering why the president that you know as a politician, as a friend, convince people. He's not selling this thing still.
I think that's been a real problem, Marjorie. I really agree with you. I think we've talked about this in the past. You know, when we launched the implementation here of healthcare reform, we had a pretty well thought out and coordinated and actually evolving plan that went beyond government because, the healthcare industry, business leaders, labor – we're all a part of selling the thing. You remember that one of the biggest issues here was the so-called invincibles, who are the young, sort of 20s, healthy men
right.
who were uninsured and weren't going to sign up because they felt they'd always be young and healthy and strong. But the principle of insurance is having as many people in the pool as possible so you can spread the risk as widely as possible. And so we engaged with the sports teams who would make announcements during games about how important it was to sign up. And so, I mean, it was very much a whole community, all hands on deck, explain the thing, answer questions, and encourage people to be a part of it. And the president and the administration have not done that or hadn't done that. They're doing it now, but they're coming from behind because the other side has been trashing it from the day it was enacted.
But Governor, if the other side is so far winning the public debate, the most recent poll I saw was something like a 10-point margin of the American people being opposed to Obamacare as opposed to supporting it. As much as Ted Cruz was called by his own Republican colleague Peter King a total fraud, why shouldn't the Republicans fight to defund something that the American people don't support?
Well, first of all, what the American people don't support, according to those to some of those polls, is something called Obamacare. Ask them if they like the idea of keeping their kids on their insurance until 26 or not being thrown off their insurance if they get sick and when they get sick, that they don't have the risk anymore of going bankrupt on account of a serious and unexpected illness, that you can get insurance even if you have a previous condition. I think I'm using the right pre-existing condition. They like all those things, and they didn't have any of those things until Obamacare went into effect. And you know, I have said to the secretary and to the president, you know, you should let us tell our story about what's happened in Massachusetts, because it's been so overwhelmingly positive, and people experience it that way. You'll see when the rates come out for the quarter. I guess it's the one that starts in January. You know, we're at a 0 to 2%, less than 2% increase in rates. That's a big change from where we used to be. And with the range of new products that are available, particularly if you're an individual, your opportunity to see your rates go down is pretty significant. And I'm talking about not just a percentage or two, like 10, 12%. So I think there is a lot more to be done in talking about the value of this. And my point in the quote that you read, Marjorie, is that I just – there's something really upside down about trashing an idea which helps people help themselves and does it in a market-based way, which is what Republicans used to say they preferred.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Bob is calling from Boston. Bob, you there?
Hello, Governor.
Good morning or afternoon.
Good afternoon. Before my two questions, I want to say I think
one per customer.
Okay, I think you've been an excellent governor.
Oh, take your time. Ask as many. Thank you.
And I really applaud your transportation initiative. The problem I see is this, that I think the MBTA focus is in eastern Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived most of my life in western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm sure you know, we have two states. One, Massachusetts, that's relatively prosperous, and the other is the western four counties,
mm-hmm.
which always have a much higher unemployment rate as well as lower housing costs and so forth. It's a different part of the state.
Yes.
Why doesn't the MBTA, after constructing the Greenbush line, after taking this initiative now down to the South Shore,
yeah.
and I see they're even talking about going to Plasto, why not extend the train from Worcester west? Buy up the track rights that they just bought between Framingham and Worcester.
Yep.
And get a fast train out
yep.
there.
Yep.
So people in the west can have access to the dynamic economy in the east, and people in the east who want lower housing costs can move farther west.
Couldn't agree with you more. The CSX owns that right of way. We have been in discussions with them. That is a part of the way forward, which is the transportation plan we propose that has not been funded. The other part of this, Bob, in terms of the Western focus, is you will know from your experience out there that the economic orientation is much more north-south than east-west, meaning people look to Connecticut and New York and to some extent up to Vermont more than they do and to New York, for that matter, New York State. Out the Albany way, more than they do to the east. And so the work on I-91, the viaduct in downtown Springfield, which is falling down and must be saved and redesigned in order for that key artery to work, the train up from New Haven through Massachusetts up the Pioneer Valley and up to Vermont, and even the proposal to revive the Housatonic line, which runs from Pittsfield down to Grand Central Station, were all a part of this plan. Then the last thing I would just say, because Marjorie's holding a piece of paper like she's about to give me a zinger.
no, I'm not.
is that the RTAs, the regional transit authorities, which operate in the Pioneer Valley, and there's obviously one out in Berkshire County as well, they have equipment aging issues as deep as the T. And funding the improvement and modernization of that equipment and enabling them, because they then would have to spend a little less, in many cases a lot less, on maintenance to expand their service is a part of that plan too.
Bob, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, Governor Patrick, ready for my zinger?
Yes.
We're joined by Governor Bob Patrick for a monthly feature, Ask the Governor.
Oh, that's it?
He's taking your calls at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. That conversation continues in just a couple of seconds on 89.7 WGBH.
If paying tuition isn't tough enough for most students, they're forced to pay hundreds of dollars more in fees.
On Campus, the WGBH News Higher Ed Desk with reporter Kirk Carapeza on WGBH Radio.
Many companies stand with their employees in supporting public radio here in New England with matching gifts. Find out if your employer will double or even triple your contribution to WGBH. Ask at work or visit wgbh.org/matching gifts.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Mass Eye and Ear, offering specialty services at more than a dozen locations in the Boston area, and now a new center in the Longwood Medical Area. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Boston University's Executive MBA, Real Classroom, Real Outcomes, online information session September 28th at 9 a.m. You can learn more at bu.edu/embA.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is the monthly visit of Governor Deval Patrick. Take your calls or questions. We'll get back to your calls at 877-301-8970 in a second. A couple of very quick things, Governor. In the wake of this horror show in Kenya, is there greater security or is anything different at the malls in Massachusetts?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Second, we've asked you a lot of questions in the wake of the marathon about some of the FBI procedures. The Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts and Florida asked the attorneys general of the two states who had in the case of Florida, an Orlando cop, in the case of Massachusetts, two state troopers, at least in the apartment at some time around the time that the FBI shot and killed this guy, Ibrahim Todashev, who allegedly was about to admit that he and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham 2 years earlier on 9/11. Mm-hmm. The Attorney General, Martha Coakley, said, I'm going to reject that request. I am not going to look into it, even though the FBI has not released a report. Do you support the Attorney General's decision?
I do. It's an active investigation. There will be more on that coming out from the FBI in the fullness of time. But there's still some threads that they're pursuing, and I want to respect that.
We're getting a lot of emails about MCAS. Could you give us – we know the results were out in the last couple of days. Give us what you consider to be the highs and the lows, the best news and the worst news.
Best news is that our young people are performing at even higher levels than the high levels at which they have been performing, and that is great. 14 of the – I think it was 34 schools who were originally in the turnaround cohort have emerged from turnaround status, in some cases gone from level 4, which is that turnaround, right up to level 1. Orchard Gardens is a school you know I have a soft spot for and have visited a number of times.
Tell people what a turnaround school is.
So a turnaround school is a school where there has been chronic underperformance on MCAS, and there are a couple of other measures as well, and where the through the Achievement Gap Act you get, which we enacted in 2010, I think it was, some rules and tools that are now allow for more aggressive intervention to try some things. It's not the same thing everywhere. You got to come up with a plan and what have you. And you have 3 years to work on that. So this was a key measure for that original cohort. So great, great progress there. The achievement gap exists still, but it's closed a little bit. So kids of color and kids who speak English as a second language and with special needs have improved as everyone else has improved and improved a little faster as a group, so that margin is narrowing. At the same time, there are I think 4 or 5 schools, I don't remember the exact number as I sit here, who that have gotten worse, at least as with MCAS as a measure. And this is a journey, so. I would say on the whole it's very positive news, and there's still more to do.
One last quick thing. I'm not clear. I read the other day that there is about to be this consortium of states exploring online standardized testing, potentially to replace MCAS. Can you give us the short version? What's being
contemplated? So it's called
contemplated?
PARC. So here's the one of the odd realities about performance in Massachusetts. We've got all this great stuff happening in all these different schools, district schools, charter schools. Kids are – we're number one in the nation in student achievement. We have been for each of the last 6 years. And yet for a large proportion of the – and I don't remember the number. I don't think it's a majority, but a large proportion of our high school graduates who then go to state universities and colleges, they're having to take effectively remedial courses. So their college readiness doesn't quite comport with being these high-performing students. And so PARCC is about – I think that's the acronym, P-A-R-C-C, I think it is – is a tool that is meant to incorporate MCAS. I'm being more descriptive than detailed here, but incorporate the objectives of MCAS, but also take it to the level of college readiness to see that we can eliminate that gap as well.
Okay, back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick at 877-301-8970, Governor.
Okay, Tim is on the road.
Hi there.
Hi, Tim.
Thanks for taking my call, and I want to apologize ahead of time for such a mundane question to the governor. I called the show several months ago when the governor was lobbying for the infrastructure fund. And we talked about an issue that exists.
Hey, Tim, Tim, the connection is so bad. You have to ask the question concisely or we're not going to be able to hear you.
Can't hear you, yeah.
So please do it if you can in fairly short order. Sorry.
Okay. Hope you can hear me a little better. I'm calling about
Jim, by the way. I have all the time in the world.
I'm calling about the lack of restroom facilities 24/7 at the Massachusetts State Line. It's especially relevant now that the state is spending almost $300 million for a new bridge, much needed, by the way, about 3 miles south of the state line, yet pull into the Welcome to Massachusetts rest area. If you're okay, if you're 9 to 5, that's what it says on the door, and it also gives you directions to get off the highway and go to a gas station.
Hey, Tim, I've got to let you go only because it's a
I think
horrible
Tim called
sound.
About this before.
He did. He said it's his second call.
And I think Tim also said something about being of a certain time in life where it was important to be. am I remembering
some people?
This call?
I believe that's right. I think a number
I'm
of people can relate
to
that.
I'm very sensitive to this.
So what's going on? Are you doing something about it or what?
Well, I think that so there are two questions. One was the about the investing in the upgrade and modernization of the bathrooms, and that'll happen in the course of other infrastructure work. But I think the other was the rest areas being at the welcome centers being open
9 to 5
after hours,
only, yeah.
And that's tough because they are inside facilities that have to be staffed, and it's one of the ways where we're not able to support all that staffing. There's a question, the answer to which I don't know, but I will ask, and that is whether there's a way to keep the building open and shut down the stuff that has to be staffed so it's secure, so that people can come in and out. I don't know what the security issues are or the staffing issues are around that, but I can find out.
Back to the calls, Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Joanna is calling from Norwood. Joanna.
Joanna.
I lost Joanna.
We're going to put you on hold. Let's take another one. We'll get back to Joanna in a second, Governor.
Okay. Peter, calling from North Reading. Peter, you there?
Yeah, hello.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I have a question about the tech tax. Why was there such a big rush to repeal the tech tax, you know what I mean, and not so much on a gas tax or a cigarette tax? You know what I mean? It just seems once you guys implicated that, all of a sudden the big business, the tech companies kind of went crazy about it, and now we're talking about pulling it back.
Yeah.
And which, I mean, I'm going to be a speculator here, but, you know, a lot of those companies, big donators to certain political people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think that was a motivator, but I think your larger question that, you know, you kind of get the sense that the business people speak up and everybody jumps, and when regular folks complain, maybe not so. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, because that's how it seems to me. I mean, listen, I mean, I'm a blue-collar guy, whatever. Me and my wife, I mean, we're less than $80,000 a year
income,
whatever. You know, we buy gas, and, you know, we're talking about a legislature. I mean, how many people in the state else actually buy gas? I mean, they got the per diem thing. I mean, you yourself. I mean, when's the last time you pulled cash out of your pocket to pay for gas?
Last weekend. Thank you very much. But I get your point. I mean, look, I tried the gas tax a few years ago, Peter, and I had my head handed to me. And I learned when I was out there that at the same time people want better and safer roads, more convenient and more modern transportation, you know, public transportation and what have you, that they are very sensitive to the ways we ask them to pay for that. Certainly everybody is on board with the idea of squeezing out nonsense in existing spending in order to pay more in the actual upkeep. But the gas tax was one of those things, especially outside of the greater Boston area. And you get out west, Peter, and the energy in opposition to the gas tax is particularly strong because you got farmers, you got people who, you know, they don't have the option, commuters, of jumping on the T, for example. And that is one of the reasons why I did not propose the gas tax in this last time around. And to your point about you and your wife being in the $80,000 annual income range, the reason I proposed the framework I did was that for you and folks in your income range, your total taxes would have remained the same or gone down slightly. Because the income tax rate would go up, but the sales tax would go down. And the sales tax is one of the most regressive taxes, at least in my view. But, yeah, I mean, I understand. I think the I think I said this earlier, the people of the Commonwealth through their legislature are going to have to come back to the question of what kind of Commonwealth we want, including and most specifically how we what kind of transportation network we want and what's the fairest way to pay for it.
Well, Peter, thanks. On that note, Governor, you said before you said that in the context of the tech tax repeal and how does one fill the hole of $161 million if, as you say, we need this transportation investment. You went on to say, and we didn't follow up on it, that'll probably be left to my successor after I'm gone, is what's implicit in that response is you have no intention in the next year plus of filing anything that would be a tax increase, a new tax, an expansion of a tax, anything that would be new revenue?
Well, I don't really see. I mean, I got to file a budget in January, but it's not what I anticipate doing. I mean, it was very telling in the meeting that I'm sorry, just lean back in the chair. I realize I may not. Can everyone
okay.
out there hear me?
We're good. Yes.
It was very telling in the meeting where that I mentioned with the tech industry when the leadership, you know, various people were suggesting different things and they kept taking things off the table. So, you know, I don't want to propose anything that is a waste of time from the outset. And I think, you know, that the legislature is rightly hesitant to raise taxes. You want a legislature to be hesitant to raise taxes. To think about it and take their time, and that was part of my objection to what they ultimately did because they proposed it one day and they enacted it 10 days later with no hearing.
Speaking of the legislature, before we get back to the calls, Dan Winslow, whom you said kind things about when he announced his resignation from the legislature the other day, a Republican who is from Norfolk, who is leaving, I think, on the 29th, will bring down to 29 the number of Republicans in the House of Representatives. Bob Hedlund, a state senator, indicated to Marjorie and me the other day that he will leave, quote, sooner rather than later, which
really
means we'll be down to potentially two Republicans in the Senate. As good and loyal a Democrat as you are, on that moment when Bob Hedlund leaves, I'll do the math, that's going to be 169 Democrats and 31 Republicans. Is that good for small D democracy, such an imbalance
well,
in two-party rule?
So, you know, I have – first of all, we need a strong Republican Party. We need a loyal opposition. We do not need obstructionists and radicals, frankly, in either party. And that's what I was getting at in terms of the National Republican Party – Marjorie, in the quote you threw in my face,
leading us over the cliff.
Right. But I think I've told you before, the dynamic, as I experience it on Beacon Hill, is not Republican-Democrat. It's insider-outsider. We have Democrats, God love them, in our legislature who in other states would be Republicans. We have a whole range of philosophies. And I think probably like a lot of legislative bodies, relationships have a whole lot to do with things moving. And it's not all about the merits. It's also about the merits, but it's other stuff too. And I think that the Speaker and the Minority Leader on the House side and the Senate President and the Minority Leader on the Senate side have a really great working relationship. They don't and they help each other as they can, and when they have a principal difference, they have a principal difference.
Back to the calls, Governor DeVal Patrick, 877-301-8970.
Let's see who is calling. Bill is on the road. Bill?
Welcome, Bill.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
That's a good connection. I was afraid we were going to get another one of those choppy.
Governor.
I pulled over, Governor.
There you go.
So my question is, and I'm a small businessman. I have 15 employees in my company.
Yep.
And healthcare is a huge expense to me. Out of the 15, we have 6 that are on healthcare, and the rest are not, including myself.
On your own company's healthcare plan?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, my company's healthcare plan. And I'm not on it. I own the company, but my wife's a school teacher in Quincy, and I'm on her health care.
Yes.
Because it's a tremendous savings for me.
Yes, yes.
And it's a huge expense for me. It's actually hindering me from growing because I can't add another body because, you know, someone's husband just lost their job. Her family has to come on. My expense goes up again another $10,000 a year for that. So, you know, and that's part of doing business, and I get it. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying, what options does a small business like me have to take my 5 employees or 6 employees who are going to be on it and get with a larger group of other people to help, like you said, help defray the cost so I can try to drive costs out and give them what they want.
Yep.
People are not leaving my health plan to go on their husbands or wives because I'm offering something better than their husband or wife gets. So
yes.
I'm incurring more people. I'm getting more people to come to it. And that's not what I want.
Yeah.
I don't want to discourage them coming, but I want to try to keep my expenses down.
Sure you do.
It's going to cost me $60,000 to $70,000 this year, and that's a body.
So, Bill, I'm glad you asked the question for a couple reasons. It gives me a chance to make a couple points. And if you would please not hang up, I just want to get a telephone number where we can follow up because there's some specific help they can give you at the connector.
So stay on the line when the governor's finished responding, Bill, please. Go ahead.
Just Governor. Two things I want to say. First of all, we enacted some legislation a couple of years ago that permitted through some of the small business associations, small businesses to come together to aggregate so they could have buying power comparable to the buying power that big businesses have, which is considerable. And Bill, if you stay on the line, we'll get you some information about that because it may be helpful to you. The other thing is a culture change that we need, I think, in Massachusetts and in this country, and that's this whole idea of shopping to save. What I hear from small businesses in particular is that they have this annual merry-go-round where they get their premium increase and they immediately start the conversation about how to buy or provide less insurance for the same price, meaning, you know, a bigger deductible, a change in the copay or something like that, to manage their own costs, rather than seeing what else is offered by other companies, similar coverage at the same or a lower price. And because there is a lot more information available up on the web, thanks to Obamacare, by the way, this is a lot easier to do starting the 1st of October and getting easier right through next year. So Bill, if you will stay on, we'll have somebody follow up with you and show you what tools are available and what tools and alert you to what tools will be available over the coming weeks and months.
Governor, before we continue with the calls, you know, Marjorie has read, I think, two times now your comments from Jersey yesterday, a band of radicals who want to drag the country and its economy over a cliff, describing some in Washington. We want you to listen to something else that was said in Washington this week, and I know Marjorie wants to ask you something. Here it is.
Not right now, because he did promise us. Yeah. We give him two terms, and then he'd go back to private life. But I'm not ruling it out. I mean, I think it would be really, really hard to have a father who's the president. But my governor is kind of awesome, and I really love him.
Is that another radical who wants to drag the country down? Who is that? Obviously some crazy. Who is that?
That's our youngest daughter, Catherine. You watch what you say.
Exactly. What was she talking about, Governor Patrick?
We were together at an event in Washington where we were interviewed by an anchor from MSNBC. And the question, totally off topic, was, am I going to run for president? And she answered.
And she said she wasn't ruling it out.
Yes.
Are you?
Look, I'm not going to – maybe. But listen, I'm not making any news. I'm saying the same thing I've ever always said. I am going to finish the job I have, and I am loving it. And when I finish the job I have, I am going to find a job in the private sector. And I hope there will come a time sometime later in life when I have something else I can contribute to public life. And when that time comes, we'll see.
So, but Governor, I interviewed John Walsh the other day, the outgoing chair of the Democratic State Committee, who obviously was intimately involved in your campaigns and generally is seen as one of the, by Republicans and Democrats, as one of the great political operatives in Massachusetts.
He is.
I knew that he was going to be doing some work for your political action committee. Mm-hmm. What I did not know till the other day is that he was doing it full time. I thought he was going back to his insurance company. Mm-hmm. What kind of political action committee has a full time director who's one of the most sophisticated political operatives for a guy who intends to go back to the private sector and may or may not get involved in politics again?
You know, Jim, I still have a voice. I'm still involved. I'm still interested in candidates and campaigns that are about conviction politics and governing for the long term instead of just the next election cycle. I think that is a change we brought to the governor's office and to politics here, and frankly, the whole emphasis on the grassroots is something that we help to revive here in Massachusetts. And so I'm involved, and I want to be involved in that nationally, and I will be right through to the end of my time as governor.
You know, one more question about your daughter. During the same event where you were interviewed by the host from MSNBC, your daughter talked about announcing that she was gay to her mom and dad. And she says she made the announcement, and then her father says to her, "So, do you want ham or tuna on your sandwich?" I mean, that's a pretty momentous moment. Is that really true? Is that what you said? You
want
ham or tuna?
We were out in Western Massachusetts. We were getting lunch ready for the family, and mm-hmm. And she kept saying, you know, I have something I want to say to you. And I need you and mom in the same place. And she came into the kitchen. We're gathering stuff, and people were sitting out. We're outside, and I actually don't remember saying that. I thought I said, "Will you grab the mayonnaise and let's go out."
A variation on a theme.
Okay.
Governor, we have time for...
You know, you love your kids. You love your kids. Yeah. We have a grandchild now, and you know, instantly and magically, we are totally in love with this kid. And he's going to have his ups and downs and his ins and outs, and he's going to make his mom and dad crazy and probably cause us worry, but you have to love him. And the fact that you have to is actually turns out to be pretty easy.
You know, Governor, we're usually here at noon when we don't have a hard, as it's called, out time. We have a minute and a half, so let's try to squeeze in one call and an answer if we can.
Okay.
Governor DeVal Patrick.
Okay, Brian is calling from Southbridge. Brian, you there?
Got to be brief, Brian.
Yep. I've never been involved in politics until up recently.
Me neither.
Well, you did a good job when I was serving in the National Guard, so I'll give you credit for that.
Thank you.
But, my current job now, I drive overnights on a standard route, and everybody's talking about the transportation tax and everything like that. And I've been noticing a lot of repairs on bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll watch it for weeks, and it seems like it's done. and all of a sudden the barriers are back up and they're digging up whatever they just fixed again. And I was just wondering, what's the oversight? I don't see Mass DOT out there. It seems like it's all subcontracted. And I'm just worried about tax going up for this.
Brian, we have to let the governor answer. Yeah, please.
Well, really quickly, most of the construction done in Massachusetts is done privately, and some of – I don't know what projects in particular you've seen, but some of it will have to do with when the utilities are available to come back and do their part of the project. And coordinating that has been a perennial challenge.
Now, by the way, as the governor always says at this point, I'll preempt him. Every email that was sent that where we didn't
yeah,
cover a
I'm
topic –
I'm sorry, you guys.
– will be forwarded to his office. Everybody in line, stay on. We'll take your phone number, and the governor's office will be back in touch. Governor, it's great to see you.
Great
we'll see you next month.
You.
Thank you so much for your time.
And again, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the emails, but Governor Deval Patrick does join us every month for Ask the Governor, and thank you again for being here with us. Thank you guys for listening. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of – I was going to say the Egan and Browdy Show, but it's not
that anymore.
No, that
was a long time ago,
Margaret. It is, in fact, Boston Public Radio, and we are a production of WGBH Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Governor, for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And thank you guys for tuning in. See you tomorrow.